Cause I don't have a wooden horse.
Isn't that an absolutely magnificent song to have number one the day you're born? Sensational. Beat that. If you've had a better song, and I know you'll be sending me stuff that was number one during the 90s, but that's cool. That's cool. I'm fine with that. I accept my age. I accept where I am now. It's cool. Happy to be this age. You would read into that. You would say it's a bit of an omen, isn't it? Elvis Presley, number one the day you're born. A song as cool as that. He sings in German at one point. You put all those things together and you think it's a good omen. Of course, if the song that was number one the day you weren't born, the day you were born was rubbish, just ignore it. Just ignore it. It's only a superstition. Don't be silly. What you'd say. What was number one when you were born? Let me know. 53106, the text number. Some of your texts, just want to say thanks, really. And thanks very much for what you've been saying to me. It's very nice. Sean and Douglas, thank you very much. Miriam heading back to work tomorrow after a few months off with your health. I hope that goes great for you, Miriam. And hope your recovery continues to be very, very good indeed. Tina, thank you very much. Let me see. Julia, thank you very much for your text as well. Ian and Rathmines, you too. Graham and Oisin, who appear to be Manchester City fans, but sure, we can't have everything. In Offaly and Vincent and Cork, all of you, thanks so much indeed. Some of the stuff that's been going around really catching my attention, the Cranberries. I have to say, heartbreaking year last year with Dolores' passing. And this album, it's still to come out. It's coming out in, I think it's going to be April, and it's going to be called The End. But if this is any indication of what to expect, this is beautiful. This is one of the best things I think the Cranberries I've done in a very long time. Have you three tuned for this, or you're done already?
I'm done.
Yeah, before we go to that, you're in the news a little bit at the moment. You're all right talking about that?
We'll do it very
gentle.
Briefly.
I'll be gentle. But you were one of the people invited to play with the Pope.
Yeah.
You got a phone call, they said, what exactly?
Would you play for the Pope?
Right. And
been chasing me around.
Did you have
I'm
to think
to
about
it?
Did time. You have to think about it, or did they? You know,
I did have to think about it. I mean, you'd have to have a think about it. You know,
you weren't straight away. No.
No. Well,
man,
I mean,
yes, the man is.
Yes,
coming
I was
you.
Actually. My instant reaction was, "There's no way I would do that." And then, you know, there is a certain amount of it. It appeals to. Not appeals to, but you're afraid of who you might offend, and I think certainly older generations are afraid of offending their own parents' sensibilities, and they don't want to betray anybody, insult anybody's memory, and you know, I mean, when I was a kid, I wanted to be a priest. I later realized it was because I used to remember all the words, I used to recite the prayers, you know, and I think I liked words, like lyrics,
okay,
you
right.
know, but. There was a nostalgia to that part of your life, and even a priest gave me my first guitar. So,
right,
I'm, you know, it's not something that I enjoyed turning down, but it's just, you know, and I have every respect for people's faith or whatever okay. they believe in.
They announced the lineup today.
I saw that.
Nathan Carter and Daniel O'Donnell.
Yeah. Well, it just
can't see you in that category.
No. Well, that's because I turned it down first, and then they got those lads. I said, Well, look, it just wasn't a gig for me. You know, I felt that there's too much water under the bridge. Simple as that.
Okay.
You know?
Fair enough.
Yeah.
You're going to do Galileo.
Yeah.
This is an example of a song that has been kind to you, isn't it?
It's been very kind to me, this song. I've been kind to it too, Tom.
You have?
No. Where would it be without me?
It's like... but you know what people say, that you write, you know, 100 songs and you never know which one is going to be the one that suddenly, you know, comes back at you and goes around the world and gets covered by people. And
It's a very interesting phenomenon to see that. It's just like... I was thinking about it recently. They're like... Your songs are like horses in a race. And some of them are just so far out ahead that the other one's never going to catch
them. Did you know it was out ahead? Because that's one of the things.
No, sometimes, I didn't. Yeah, when I was writing that song, I loved it because it reminded me of old, nostalgic, croonery music that I loved and like my granddad loved. And the kind of songs that I was aiming for were like, you know, the old Irving Berlin kind of things where you just say they don't make them like that anymore. They don't. you're locked into this tiny universe and everything is beautiful, and you don't know where the writer started the song. You can't tell where he began it. It's like a circle.
Yeah.
And I was really enjoying it, and but I thought nobody else would be interested in it. I really thought that until you played it, Tom. And I would have never thought of it as a single. I had my three singles written and lined up as far as I was concerned. And, you know, that you ruined my plan. Actually.
Sorry about that. You have my sincere apologies.
In such a nice way.
So you're going to do it for us now.
I will.
Looking forward to it. Bring it on. Declan O'Rourke. It's been an absolute blast, really, hasn't it?
It's been so surreal, I can't even begin to tell you. And, you know, it was surreal enough when our career sort of first kicked off. And that was really extraordinary. But the whole time it was happening, I was like, this will never last. There's no way, you know. We just got lucky and, you know, we're now sort of 25 years down the line. And if anything, I feel even more lucky now than I did back then, you know, to have a career at my age as a woman in the music industry is really rare. And you know, it's astounding. You know, I stepped on stage last night in Raleigh, North Carolina, and like, you know, there's over 1,000 people there, and it's just like, how is this possible? How is this happening to me, you know? But it's wonderful. I'm so thrilled.
I listened to your Bob Lefsetz podcast. I'm not sure when you recorded that, but you were talking in that about Goodbye, Mr. McKenzie. Wow. And the auditions and being so nervous joining Garbage that you actually couldn't sing during the audition.
Yeah, I mean, it's arguable whether I can sing anyway.
Anna, come on.
on my best days. But yeah, you know, my whole life I've suffered from a lack of certain kind of confidence. I've got oodles of confidence in so many ways, but when I'm really up against it, for some reason, I just sort of lose my kahunas. And that was one of those moments when I really just clammed up, and I knew it was an extraordinary opportunity I was being given to, you know, sing in front of, at that time, you know, the premier rock producer in the world.
Yeah.
And I just couldn't get it together, and I was so frustrated and so annoyed with myself. But luckily the band felt that there was something in me that they liked, you know, that they felt that they connected to, and so they allowed me to come back and try again, and this time it sort of came together.
They described it as the X Factor. I read a little bit of the book that you released, the band released, This Is the Noise That Keeps Me Awake, where they described you as the X Factor coming into all that. Can you see that?
Well, you know, I mean, I've been with my band now for so long, and yeah, we all sort of complement one another. I mean, we wouldn't have been together this long if we didn't have something simpatico, you know. They are definitely way more mellow and sort of laid back than I am, and I've sort of always been this sort of, like, free spirit, I suppose, and that has worked well for us. I think if we were all like me, it would be a nightmare, and if we were all like them, it would be a nightmare. Gotta let me know.
Should I go? That is the question. Should I stay or should I go to the Spice Girls this coming Friday? Can I survive it? Can my reputation survive it? Will I be seen there? Will I be photographed? Could I spiral out of control? What am I going to do? 53106 for your texts. Calm says, don't do it, Tom, to say no. Then again, the first album I ever bought was Parallel Lines from Blondie, a classic. The first single for it was actually Sally Oldfield's Mirrors. Wow, Colm, I wouldn't admit that on Twitter if I was you. My options are A, Daddy's working this Friday, darling. B, am I definitely your daddy? And C, there is no C. C is go to the Spice Girls, isn't it? Oh, gosh.
First day of April 1963, mother fell in the lap of luxury.
I remember rehearsing with Planxty in the old Metropole on O'Connell Street, and it was the first time Andy took out his harmonica and played it with the Ellen Pipes. Fuck.
Really?
It was just a blow away moment.
Really?
Yeah. the harmonica and the inland pipes just, oh. I can remember our manager then, Des Kelly, weeping.
Really?
Crying at the sound of the harmonica and the inland pipes. Yeah.
Those moments must be incredibly special. The inland pipes as well. What an instrument, what a player.
What an instrument.
I know when you're in an audience and the Uilleann pipes come in, especially in Raggle Tackle Gypsies, yeah, and you tour them, it blows you away. It must, on stage, it must be hard to keep concentration.
Some of my favourite piping moments in Planxty were when Liam was playing solo. You know, he used to play the gold ring occasionally, and I mean, the pipes are an amazing instrument, but particularly when played by Liam O'Flynn. I've been listening to him almost every day since he died. And I saw a very interesting documentary that was made about Liam, and I always knew he was a horseman, and I always knew that he rode, but I saw a film of him riding out on a gallop, and he was a wonderful horseman, and he was like a professional jockey. And it dawned on me, that's a bit like playing the Uilleann pipes, because there's so many different things you have to do playing the pipes, and so many different, you've got to be so much in control. And it's the same riding a thoroughbred horse at high speed.
It's funny to see the parallels.
Yeah.
And beautiful player, beautiful. I think to have shared a stage with him, that's very special. Well,
probably the greatest honour of my working life.
Yeah, it's great to appreciate it.
Yeah.
But when did you then go from stop doing side projects to going into the studio and thinking, right, I better record these songs?
Again, it's a continuous line. I don't really differentiate, nor do I plan or conceptualize. And it doesn't crystallize until it's done. And then I know how to accompany the music with the visuals. So it really is, I'm just on a path. I'm like being led, and I follow the muse. And life and my work, it's parallel.
Right.
And it's chicken and egg. Like, I don't know what comes first.
Okay.
The work or the feeling or the song or the thing, or do I make the experience because I write the song? I do feel like I'm manifesting these things in a very magical way right now.
Right. You're reminding me a bit of the band The Blue Nile. Do you know The Blue Nile at all?
No. What's the name?
Oh, they're a brilliant band from Scotland. Only released an album about every 8 years or so. And when the Ray Norman was sent to Scotland from London to try and report back on why it was taking so long, the singer said he felt like he was a ghost in a Forrester novel being pursued through the forest. That was the answer he had to give to the A&R men back in London. In other words, they haven't already yet, which is fair enough.
Well, how can you argue with that?
You can't.
Okay.
You can't.
The process of an artist. It's just, there's so much pressure on time.
Yeah.
But it really doesn't matter. It's irrelevant. And if you're writing to your whole life, it comes when it comes.
Right.
You know, it's like my favorite artists are, you know, Leonard Cohen. That last record was a masterpiece.
Masterpiece, absolutely. So when it did kind of come together and you went into the studio, this bit of it must be almost giggly for you, because in the recording of this, you have Ringo Starr with you in the studio. That's a bit of a showstopper, isn't it? How did that come about?
I think I manifested Ringo by watching a video of him that he, from one of his solo records, Only You, a cover of Only You. And the video is Ringo and Harry Nilsson on top of the Capitol Records building. Ringo's wearing a blue jumpsuit with a silver star, and there's a giant paper mache spaceship on top of Capitol. And I came to this video while I was living in New York and making the NAF record, and this French guy rolled into the shop that my friend had, a shop in the East Village where we made this record, and he was watching this video on his phone, this French guy on a motorcycle, and he showed us this video of Ringo, and I watched it 100 times, 1,000 times. I was obsessed. And then a year later, we're talking about, you know, putting together a band for the record, you know, Don Was and Ben Montench and Jim Keltner, and Ringo was in the consciousness. So I don't even know how he ended up there, honestly, but I think it was this kind of magic.
right,
tapping into this kind of magic.
When someone like Ringo comes into the studio and he's drumming on your record, are you in a position to critique him? Could you say, have another go at that, Ringo? I don't think that's your best work. Or how would that be?
Music is intuitive, and the vibe was right.
Right.
And we were feeling it, and there was no... Yeah, there was nothing to say. There was the song, which he understood.
Yeah.
And there's live music, so I'm tracking my vocals live with his drums, and it was just... We did it maybe three times. We cut Heads Gonna Roll. And then Jim came down, Jim Keltner from the lounge... And we had both of their drum kits set up. And Jim and Ringo played together for maybe 40 minutes, just the two of them, in Capitol Records Studio B. And that became the rhythm track, the drum track for Red Bull and Hennessy, the double drum sound.
Yeah.
But that just happened on its own.
Wow.
And that feeling with those two guys playing together in a room was just... What, just the coolest thing I've ever heard.
I can imagine
and
that
felt.
That's pretty hard to top.
That is reminding me of it was a later festival. It wasn't Fela, where the Saw Dogs were on, and so was Snoop Dogg. And they met each other on the corridor, and Snoop Dogg, the Saw Dogs were walking down the corridor with a tray of ham sandwiches, and Snoop Dogg's walking the other way with a gold chalice of wine.
Oh God, do you remember the Saw Doctors on stage and they had bales of hay? It was, yes, like they were, I thought they were bringing the hay to sort of like put on the mud or something like that, but no, they were props on the stage for the Saw Doctors, because they have that song, Bailin' Bailin', Hey Hey. That was great. Fela was great back then. It was so different as well, unlike modern festivals. Everybody was kind of in the one stadium looking at the one stage. So, you know, all the kids, they were like, they'd be watching Iggy Pop one minute, or, you know, Cypress Hill or something like that. Yeah. And then they'd have Chris de Burgh.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, and they just sat through it and, you know, watched it all. And, well, you know,
strippers.
Chris de Burgh did, didn't he? Yeah. For Patricia the Stripper. Yeah.
What was that about?
I don't know. A bit obvious.
Yeah, Christ. There were only children in the audience.
Were condoms legal back then?
Who knows? Steve, rock on.